This is Alex Johnson, and welcome to The Deep Dive.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Today, our mission is one of exhaustive, granular detail. We're doing a rapid response analysis, and we're calling it the Federal News Update for Thursday, November 27th, 2025.
Yeah, this is a complete systematic breakdown of basically every major move made by the U.S. federal government since Wednesday, November 26th began.
And this 24-hour period was not quiet, not at all. It was immediately defined by a violent domestic security crisis.
And that crisis acted as a kind of high-speed accelerator for policy changes that were, you know, clearly pre-planned.
Changes across defense, immigration, trade, it's all connected. We're going to walk you through how the government pivoted to what really feels like a war footing, both here at home and abroad.
It's true. If you step back and look at the whole picture of November 26th, The one central theme is this strategic assertion and consolidation of executive authority.
Right.
The administration took a sudden, really tragic domestic event, a moment of crisis, and just instantly leveraged it.
It became the justification. The springboard.
Exactly. The springboard to implement initiatives that are designed to fundamentally reorganize the federal state. I mean, we are looking at revocation of immigration status years after the fact.
Years later, yeah.
The militarization of counter-narcotics efforts and this intense ongoing pressure on the federal workforce. Our goal here is to connect these seemingly disparate events for you to show you how they all feed into the same overarching strategy.
Okay, let's unpack this and jump right into that central event, the one that provided the kinetic energy for everything that followed, the security crisis right here in the nation's capital.
This incident, it shattered the uneasy peace of downtown D.C. It happened at approximately 2:15 p.m. on November 26th.
And it was just a short distance from the White House, specifically near 17th and H Streets and W.
That location is so significant. It's right in the heart of the federal complex.
And the details are stark. Two members of the West Virginia National Guard were ambushed. They were shot.
And D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and FBI Director Kash Patel, they immediately characterized it as a targeted attack.
That framing targeted is key. It elevates it immediately.
It does. Both guardsmen were transported to the hospital, and they're in critical condition.
And the suspect's details, that's what immediately turned this from a local D.C. crime into a massive international policy issue.
The shooter, Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, is an Afghan national. He entered the U.S. back in September of 2021.
He was wounded in the exchange, and he's in custody now.
Right, but reports indicate he's refusing to cooperate. He's not talking.
So beyond just the rhetoric, how did the executive branch react? What was the immediate concrete order given to the Department of Defense?
Well, President Trump took to social media to deliver, you know, a maximalist response. He promised the shooter, who he called an animal, would pay a very steep price.
But the action, the real action, was military.
The concrete action was the order confirming the immediate deployment of 500 additional National Guard troops to the District of Columbia. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth confirmed it.
And that swelled an already huge force. There were already over 2,200 troops here.
A major surge. And the language Hegseth used to describe the Department of Defense is, well, it's far from accidental, isn't it?
No, not at all. He called the agency the War Department.
That is a deliberate linguistic signal. It's not a slip of the tongue.
Yeah.
By using the historical name, the pre-1947 name, they're signaling an intentional shift.
A shift in mindset.
Yes, a shift in the administrative and psychological mindset about their role here domestically. It suggests they view the security situation in the Capitol not as a policing issue, not an urban problem.
But as a conflict.
As a conflict requiring the assets and, crucially, the legal latitude of wartime operations. And that framing, you have to understand that framing to get the legal clash that immediately followed.
Let's dive right into that legal battlefield, because this wasn't happening in a vacuum. The administration was already deep in constitutional friction even before this shooting.
Oh, absolutely. This surge deployment put them in direct confrontation with the judiciary.
Tell us about that.
Just days before this, U.S. District Judge Jia Cobb issued a ruling that placed really significant constraints on this exact type of deployment.
What was her finding?
She found that the prolonged standing use of National Guard troops for general crime control in D.C. likely violated the D.C. Home Rule Act.
So the core legal principle she challenged was what exactly?
It was whether the president has a kind of free-floating power to deploy federal troops for standard police duties without a specific insurrection or, you know, a national emergency declared by Congress.
And she gave them time to appeal.
She did. She granted a 21-day stay on her order, fully expecting the administration to appeal.
So when the shooting happened, the Department of Justice must have seen a clear opening. A legal and political opportunity to not just appeal, but to basically invalidate the spirit of her entire ruling.
They moved with lightning speed.
Yeah.
The DOJ filed an emergency motion with the Federal Appeals Court on November 26th.
And their argument?
They argued that the attack on the guardsmen demonstrated irreparable harm to national security. And because of that harm, it necessitated the continued and expanded military presence.
So the legal maneuver here is incredibly complex. They're using the incident itself as proof that the judge was wrong.
Precisely. By framing the attack as proof of ongoing acute danger, they argued that the judicial attempt to limit the military presence, well, that itself created an unacceptable security risk.
It's a direct challenge to the court's prerogative to oversee domestic deployments.
It is. It's an aggressive legal test of the separation of powers. They're using the crisis to assert the executive's unilateral judgment in matters of national security, even right here in the Capitol.
Yeah. The implication for you, the listener, is that this isn't just about 500 troops. It's about the executive actively using a high-profile, violent incident to legally undercut judicial oversight of its military actions on American soil.
Exactly. And the courts are now placed in an impossible position. If they rule against the deployment, they risk being seen as undermining security during a recognized crisis.
The administration is forcing the judiciary to make a politically charged ruling under extreme duress.
That's the strategy.
The moment the identity of the shooter, Ramanullah Lakhanwal, an Afghan national, was confirmed, the focus just immediately exploded. It expanded from physical security in D.C. to a massive retrospective shockwave through U.S. immigration policy.
This is a perfect example of what we were talking about, using an immediate singular event to accelerate a broad, already prepared policy vector.
The shooter's nationality became the trigger.
Immediately. It triggered President Trump's call for the reinvestigation of all Afghan refugees who entered under the previous administration.
And the political statement was very clear.
Incredibly clear. If they can't love our country, we don't want them.
So the policy response was layered, right? It started with an immediate targeted freeze. What exactly did USCIS and the Department of Homeland Security do?
They instituted an indefinite suspension of all immigration processing for Afghan nationals.
All processing. So that's
all of it. This is critical because it's a blanket freeze across the board. It stops the review of special immigrant visas, the SIVs.
The ones promised to allies who helped U.S. forces?
Yes. It also halts humanitarian parole applications, and it stops asylum claims. No Afghan national, regardless of their connection to the U.S. mission or their legal pathway, is currently moving forward toward a permanent protected status.
It's a complete stop. Now, we need to dive into the core administrative mechanism that's driving this much larger review, the EDLO memo. This wasn't just a response to the shooting, was it? This has been brewing.
That's right. The EDLO memo, which was issued by USCIS Director Joseph EDLO on November 21st, but, and this is key, it was operationalized right after the D.C. shooting on the 26th. It represents a staggering administrative challenge.
What's the scope?
The scope is immense. It mandates a comprehensive review and re-interview of all 233,000 Afghan refugees admitted during a four-year window.
All of them. So that's between January 20th, 2021 and February 20th, 2025.
Every single one.
That means they are essentially relitigating decisions that were made and finalized years ago. What's the specific administrative law justification they're using to reopen these cases?
The memo's justification is where the whole legal theory rests. Mm. It asserts, and I'm quoting here, that the previous administration prioritized expediency, quantity, and admissions over quality interviews and detailed screening and vetting.
So that phrasing, that's designed to establish that the initial vetting process was flawed.
Procedurally insufficient. Exactly. In administrative law, if you can claim a procedure was flawed, it allows the agency to argue that the status granted was improperly adjudicated.
Even if the person who received it did nothing wrong, no fraud, no crime.
Correct. So they aren't necessarily looking for criminal behavior. They are looking for technical weaknesses in the original paperwork or, you know, the interview process from years ago.
So what are the specific mechanics of this retroactive review? How does it actually work on the ground?
The mechanics are designed to halt any progress toward permanent status. First, it immediately freezes all green card applications. what's called adjustment of status, for this entire group of 233,000 people.
And second?
Second, the re-interview process is designed to apply a much higher, much stricter bar than the original vetting. They're going back into archives records, security checks, biographical data, interview notes, with the goal of establishing that, under the current standard of review, the individual is inadmissible.
Or that the initial entry was just based on insufficient data.
Right. And this raises the specter of status revocation years after an individual has established a life, a home, a community here in the U.S.
The impact of this is just profound, both for the people who are already here and for our allies who are still overseas.
The humanitarian and geopolitical fallout, it really can't be overstated. For those already in the U.S., this creates a permanent state of legal precarity. Their lives are just on hold.
You can't plan. You can't travel.
You can't achieve the settled status you were promised. They are effectively an underclass of temporary residents whose entire foundation can be pulled out from under them based on a retrospective administrative review.
And what about the allies who are still waiting in third countries? We used the term lily pads earlier.
That refers to the transit centers where thousands of Afghans are housed. Many of them work directly for the U.S. military, and they're just waiting for their processing to be completed.
And now they're stuck.
They're stuck in total legal limbo. By freezing all processing and initiating this mass review, the U.S. is signaling a profound breach of the implied contract of protection offered to our allies. It severely damages U.S. credibility around the world.
It suggests that promises of protection are contingent on the political winds.
And can be summarily revoked or just indefinitely stalled.
Let's transition from that domestic security and immigration shockwave to the administration's projection of force globally. The events of November 26th also saw a really dramatic escalation of the military campaign against narcotics trafficking.
The one they've dubbed Operation Southern Spear.
Exactly.
And this pivot, it highlights how that war-footing mentality immediately transcended the domestic sphere. The administration is consolidating its strategy across all theaters of operation, applying maximum pressure everywhere.
The scale of lethal action reported on the 26th is significant. What were the specific actions taken in that 24-hour window?
The reports confirmed a massive spike in direct lethal engagements. U.S. military assets conducted strikes on four separate vessels.
And these were likely, what, drug-running semi-submersibles or go-fast boats?
Almost certainly. They were operating in the Eastern Pacific and the Caribbean. And those four strikes resulted in 14 confirmed fatalities.
14 deaths in a single day.
In a single day. And this contributes to an overall estimated death toll of between 57 and 83 individuals since the operation began in late 2025. It just underscores the severity of this sustained high lethality action.
And the allocation of military assets to this effort is just... it's truly unprecedented. It's moving far beyond what you typically see with the Coast Guard or specialized DEA operations.
We're seeing assets designed for major power projection being used for drug interdiction.
Yeah.
I mean, the deployment of the USS Gerald R. Ford Carrier Strike Group for this. It's a massive, unmistakable signal.
A nuclear-powered aircraft carrier.
A nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, costing billions of dollars, is typically reserved for conflict with peer adversaries. You know, China or Russia.
So using it in this capacity transforms the counter-narcotics effort from what was a law enforcement problem
into a full-scale military endeavor.
The crucial question then becomes, what is the legal justification for using this level of lethal force against non-state actors outside of a declared war zone?
The entire strategy hinges on one semantic and legal designation, classifying these targets as narco-terrorists.
That's the key strategic move.
It is. By affixing the terrorist designation, the administration attempts to legally shift the entire framework from standard domestic and international law enforcement standards.
Standards which mandate due process, rules of engagement that minimize harm, the goal of capture.
Right. They're trying to shift it to the law armed conflict, or LOAC.
What's the difference? What is the immense difference that shift to LOAC creates in terms of operational latitude for the military?
Under standard law enforcement, lethal force is generally a last resort. It's used in self-defense or defense of others.
Okay.
Under LOAC, once a target is designated as an enemy combatant or, you know, linked to terrorism, the rules of targeting shift dramatically.
How so?
It permits preemptive lethal force targeting of vessels and personnel based purely on intelligence. There's no immediate requirement for attempted arrest or capture. It grants the military the legal grounds to conduct shock and awe against criminal networks, viewing them as quasi-state enemies rather than domestic criminals.
It dramatically expands executive power and lethal reach in international waters.
That's the goal. And this expansion of power, predictably, has triggered a very strong constitutional response from Congress.
As it should.
It has. On November 26th, Representatives Bobby Scott and Lucy McBath sent a highly critical letter to the administration. They argue that these strikes constitute hostilities under the terms of the War Powers Resolution.
And that resolution requires the president to consult with Congress.
Yes. And report on any military actions that rise to the level of hostilities. And since Congress has not authorized a war against these specific cartels, the representatives argue the administration is unilaterally conducting military operations in violation of the separation of powers.
They also provided a strong financially backed argument against this whole militarized approach, didn't they? They cited CBO testimony.
They did. And that's the strategic component of their argument.
Mm-hmm.
The representative cited analysis showing that the high operational cost, and we're talking an estimated $6.5 million a day just to run and protect the carrier strike group.
Wow.
It yields a seizure value of narcotics that is just wholly disproportionate to the investment.
So they're arguing that this expenditure is prioritizing a political statement through high-profile military action.
Over what are fiscally responsible and proven strategies like demand reduction, treatment, and targeted law enforcement infiltration. The focus, therefore, seems to be on projecting military might rather than on cost-effective counter-narcotics success.
That economic and strategic analysis is a perfect pivot to our next major area of federal activity on November 26th. The USTR's deployment of economic statecraft.
Which reveals a highly sophisticated, yet bifurcated trade strategy, a kind of two-pronged approach.
What's fascinating here is the administration's ability to run two distinct, almost contradictory trade policies at the same time.
Right. One is a policy of highly transactional detente and accommodation with a superpower like China.
And the other?
The other is a policy of aggressive, immediate protectionist enforcement against regional partners like Mexico.
Let's start with the detente side, the China trade relationship.
Yeah.
The USTR announced the extension of 178 specific product exclusions from the Section 301 tariffs.
And they pushed the deadline way out to November 10th, 2026.
This extension is directly linked to the historic trade and economic deal that was reached between Presidents Trump and Xi Jinping on November 1st.
It is. The Section 301 tariffs, which were originally imposed on this vast range of Chinese imports, have been a core tool of trade leverage.
So by granting exclusions on these 178 specific products, many of which are, what, specialized industrial components, rare earth materials?
Yes, and parts for U.S. medical devices, the U.S. provides immediate, crucial cost relief to our own domestic manufacturers who rely on those inputs.
So the U.S. is essentially stabilizing its own supply chains while simultaneously managing the high-stakes political relationship with Beijing.
Precisely. It's managed trade. The U.S. gets to claim success on the November 1st deal, and American businesses avoid crippling costs.
Crucially, as you noted, the U.S. maintains leverage because the exclusions are temporary.
That's the key. A one-year extension means that if Beijing is judged to have violated any terms of the November 1st agreement, whether it's on intellectual property, currency, market access, the USTR can simply let those exclusions lapse in 2026.
And instantly reapply massive economic pressure without needing to pass any new legislation.
It's all built in.
Now, contrast that strategic accommodation with the aggressive enforcement action taken against Mexico on the very same day using the USMCA.
The contrast is just, it's stark.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the USTR wielded the USMCA's Rapid Response Labor Mechanism, mm-hmm. or RRM, with incredible force.
And it was against two separate Mexican entities.
Yes. Fraxinet de Mexico, a major wine producer, and Corporación de Occidente, a tire manufacturer. The RRM is a specific enforcement tool built into the new NAFTA treaty, and it's designed to protect labor rights.
What are the immediate consequences for those Mexican companies once the RRM is invoked? How does this suspension of liquidation actually work?
Suspension of liquidation is an immediate economic sanction. It means that U.S. Customs and Border Protection is instructed to halt the final processing, the liquidation of goods entering the U.S. from those specific facilities.
So if a U.S. importer can't finalize the customs process,
they face severe financial uncertainty. They can't move the product into the commerce stream. They can't guarantee the duties. This effectively acts as a near total block on entry for those specific goods.
creating intense pressure on the Mexican government and the companies themselves to immediately adhere to the RRM demands.
Demands about labor rights and union negotiations, yes.
So this is really protectionism wrapped in the language of labor enforcement.
Cool.
How does the USMCA mechanism achieve the goal of serving a domestic agenda?
The goal is known as upward harmonization. The administration argues that aggressive enforcement of high labor standards forces Mexican companies to increase wages, improve working conditions, and allow for genuine union representation.
And as Mexican labor costs rise,
the cost differential between manufacturing in Mexico and manufacturing in the U.S. shrinks. This reduces the primary incentive for U.S. companies to offshore manufacturing jobs to Mexico.
Satisfying a key domestic protectionist goal and appealing directly to U.S. labor unions.
It's a highly tactical, highly successful form of economic nationalism implemented through treaty enforcement.
Moving inward from global trade and military action, we now have to examine the continuous structural war on the bureaucracy being prosecuted right here on the home front.
Particularly the effort to reshape the federal workforce from the top down.
Which takes us directly to the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, and a memo reported on November 26th.
A memo that signals a new phase in the workforce reduction strategy, targeting senior leadership.
Right. The OPM memo advises agencies to reevaluate and potentially reduce their senior executive service, the SES, as well as senior level and scientific and professional staffing allocations.
And they have a deadline of December 19th to submit their plans.
The rationale provided by OPM is critical here. This is deemed especially important because the administration has already far surpassed its internal workforce reduction targets for 2025.
And we've seen approximately 317,000 employees leave federal service this year compared to only 68,000 new hires.
So the administration's thesis is simple.
It is. If the bulk of the workforce is shrinking, then the senior leadership layer, the people who define policy and strategy, should not remain top-heavy. This is a calculated effort at decapitation of the experienced leadership stratum to accelerate structural transformation.
But while the administration is pushing relentlessly for these cuts, their attempt to eliminate entire agencies just hit a definitive judicial roadblock this week.
And this proves the limits of executive reorganization power.
It's that check on the unitary executive theory in action.
It is. On November 21st, U.S. District Judge John J. McConnell Jr. issued a permanent injunction. It blocked the elimination of four specific agencies.
The Institute of Museum and Library Services.
The Minority Business and Development Agency. The Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. And the Interagency Council on Homelessness.
What was Judge McConnell's specific finding regarding the administration's strategy here?
He found that the administration's implementation of the closures, which included, you know, widespread layoff notices, terminating external grants, shutting down public programs, went beyond mere internal efficiency measures.
Okay.
He ruled that these actions undermine their ability to perform functions mandated by statute.
And that is powerful legal language.
It is. It asserts that because these agencies were explicitly created by Congress to fulfill specific legislative functions, like distributing library funding or mediating labor disputes, the executive branch cannot use its general managerial authority to unilaterally nullify those statutory mandates.
It's a judicial defense of the legislative will against executive overreach.
Exactly.
Now, while that leadership layer is being pressured, the rest of the federal workforce is dealing with the painful, real-world consequences of administrative failure.
Stemming from the recent 43-day government shutdown.
Yes, and the post-shutdown pay crisis, especially for DOD civilian employees, is a major story this Thanksgiving week.
This crisis reveals these deep-seated administrative incapacity failures. The shutdown ended on November 13th, and federal civilian employees, especially at the DOD, were promised up to 4 weeks of back pay between November 17th and 20th.
Yet, weeks later, many are still waiting.
Still waiting. And official guidance is now pushing the delay back until November 29th for some.
What are the root causes of this? Why are these paychecks so severely delayed? Is it just a matter of volume?
It's a combination of things. Volume, outdated technology, and severely limited administrative capacity because of those workforce cuts we just talked about.
The systems are just old.
Many federal payroll systems are decades old. They are simply not equipped to handle the rapid calculation of millions of personalized back pay and accrual adjustments all at once.
And the people who manage those systems?
The employees who manage these complex payroll functions, the finance and accounting staff, are often the first to be cut during these efficiency drives. So the result is a system failure, compounded by a severe lack of human capacity to manually check and correct the errors.
And the human impact during the holiday season is just devastating. What are the specific consequences being reported by these employees?
It's immediate financial distress. Employees are reporting significant errors in the payments that have gone out, incorrect tax withholdings, incomplete health insurance deductions, and just confusing minimal official guidance,
forcing them to seek emergency financial assistance.
Right, during Thanksgiving week. We have reports that food assistance requests for DC Guard members and their families.
The same Guard members working the DC deployment we started with.
The very same. Their food assistance requests have surged by 57%. This highlights a tragic irony. The administration is deploying the Guard for security while simultaneously causing financial hardship through administrative neglect.
Amidst all this disruption, though, there are still pockets of modernization efforts being reported, specifically from the Department of Government Efficiency.
Right, and we need to clearly define the players here, DOGE and USDS.
Go ahead.
A DOGE spokesperson confirmed on November 26th that both the temporary Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, and its long-term technology counterpart, the U.S. DOG service, or USDS, remain active.
So DOGE is the high-level restructuring effort.
And USDS, which is the newly rebranded U.S. Digital Service led by Amy Gleason, is the on-the-ground technology implementation arm.
So the USDS is the agency focused on using technology to make the reduced federal workforce more productive. They're essentially trying to offset the capacity loss with digital solutions.
That's the idea. And they are deep into three critical modernization efforts right now.
What are they?
First, they're leveraging AI and advanced analytics to process and categorize over 600,000 pieces of federal correspondence every month, reducing the workload for human staff.
Okay, that's huge.
Second, they're undertaking the complex multi-year transformation of the FAFSA system, which, you know, impacts 18 million students accessing federal financial aid. And third, and this is highly crucial, they're reducing processing delays for 600,000 veterans each month by modernizing the VA disability compensation application process.
So it shows a strategic intent. Cut the people, but use high-end technology to maintain or maybe even improve frontline service delivery.
That appears to be the plan.
Let's pivot to a major confrontation that really challenges the very structure of the separation of powers. The unprecedented escalation between the FBI and Congress, which was reported on November 26th.
This is where we see the intense friction between the executive branch and the legislature move beyond just policy disagreements.
And into the realm of legal intimidation.
Right. The FBI's counterterrorism division contacted the House and Senate sergeants at arms on November 25th, and they formally requested interviews with six sitting Democratic lawmakers.
Why are they requesting interviews with elected officials? What is the alleged offense here?
The inquiry stems from a social media video. In it, these six Democrats, all of whom have military or intelligence backgrounds, urged uniformed U.S. troops to defy what they labeled illegal orders.
And the context for that is critical.
The context is everything. This followed a social media post by President Trump accusing these very lawmakers of sedition, which he stated is, quote, punishable by death.
And FBI Director Kash Patel confirmed it's an ongoing matter.
He did.
So to be crystal clear, the FBI's counterterrorism unit is initiating an inquiry into the rhetoric of sitting members of Congress following a direct complaint from the president via social media. What does this mean constitutionally?
It is an extraordinary push against constitutional norms. It raises immediate concerns about the speech and debate clause, which grants certain immunities to members of Congress for their official remarks.
And beyond that.
Furthermore, investigating political speech, even really heated rhetoric, creates an intense chilling effect on legislative dissent. When the executive branch's primary law enforcement arm is used to investigate political opponents over protected speech, it risks weaponizing federal power to intimidate the legislature.
Which is a fundamental threat to the balance of power.
A fundamental threat. And that threat was significant enough to elicit bipartisan concern, wasn't it?
Absolutely. The pushback wasn't just limited to the Democratic side.
No. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski publicly condemned the inquiries. She called them frivolous and said the FBI and Pentagon surely have more important priorities.
The fact that members of the president's own party are criticizing the move underscores the widely perceived threat to institutional stability that this investigation represents.
It really does. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court is conducting its own high-stakes structural maneuvering regarding the boundaries of presidential power over independent agencies.
Right. The court issued a fascinating strategic move on November 26th in the case of Blanche v. Perlmutter.
The one concerning the president's attempt to fire the Register of Copyrights.
Exactly. And rather than issue an immediate ruling, the court deferred the decision.
And strategically linked it to two other key pending cases, Trump v. Slaughter and Trump v. Cook.
Why combine these three cases? What does this strategic deferral signal to the federal bureaucracy?
By linking the cases, which deal with the attempted removal of three very different types of independent officials.
The Register of Copyrights, a Federal Trade Commissioner, and a Federal Reserve Governor.
Right. By linking them, the court is signaling that it is preparing a single, unified, blockbuster ruling on the unitary executive theory.
And this is the constitutional theory that asserts that the president possesses all executive power.
And therefore have the right to control, hire, and fire anyone within the executive branch, including the heads of traditionally independent agencies, at will.
So the stakes here are monumental. If the court rules in favor of the unitary executive theory, what happens to the independence of agencies like the Federal Reserve or the SEC?
The impact would be it would fundamentally dismantle decades of administrative law precedent. Agencies like the Federal Reserve were deliberately structured by Congress to operate outside of immediate political control to ensure stability and nonpartisan decision-making.
And if the president gains the unfettered ability to fire agency heads, not for cause, but just due to policy disagreement,
it transforms them from independent bodies into direct political extensions of the White House. This strategic deferral maintains the status quo for now, but the looming decision represents an existential threat to the independence of the entire federal bureaucracy and the regulatory system.
And the final piece of this separation of powers friction on November 26th involved the legislative branch being forced to use civilian-level tools to conduct oversight.
We saw Senators Whitehouse, Blumenthal, and Schiff resort to filing extensive Freedom of Information Act FOIA requests with the Department of Justice.
The implications of this are just shocking. These are powerful senior members of the Senate Judiciary and Intelligence Committees.
They hold subpoena power, a legal mechanism that requires the executive branch to turn over information under penalty of law.
So the fact that they have publicly abandoned that path and are using FOIA, the same tool available to any citizen or journalist, to get basic governance information,
it suggests an unprecedented level of absolute stonewalling by the executive branch.
What kind of information are they being blocked from accessing that requires them to resort to this?
Their requests concern high-profile matters of public interest and potential misconduct. Information regarding charge dismissals, internal details on the Jeffrey Epstein investigation, and emoluments violations. The failure of the executive to comply with traditional oversight mechanisms forces the legislature to wait months, maybe years, for FOIA processing and potential litigation.
This is a critical breakdown in oversight.
It is, and it allows the executive to consolidate power by operating under a thick, self-imposed veil of opacity, effectively neutering congressional checks.
Shifting away from constitutional friction, let's look at the hard economic signals that were released on November 26th, even though they arrived through a thick fog created by the shutdown.
The 43-day government shutdown caused immense data lag. It's prevented policymakers and markets from having a real-time picture of the economy.
But we finally received the long-delayed September 2025 durable goods report.
We did.
What were the key data points from that report? What does it tell us about the direction of the economy?
Overall, new orders for durable goods, so manufactured items meant to last 3 years or more, they rose 0.5% in September. That suggests some resilience in the manufacturing sector.
But the most significant policy-reflecting figure was this massive, non-cyclical 23.0% spike in defense capital goods orders.
23% growth in defense orders is huge. How does this number directly reflect the administration's strategic priorities?
It correlates directly with the rearmament push and the escalated military operations we discussed earlier, like Operation Southern Spear.
Exactly. Defense capital goods include major procurement items, aircraft, naval vessels, advanced missile systems, and all the related technology. This spike confirms the administration's rhetoric about shifting to a war footing is backed by massive, immediate federal investment.
The federal government is actively injecting billions into the defense industry, driving manufacturing growth in a highly specific sector.
That's what the data shows.
However, despite that one positive defense signal, the larger issue remains the debilitating economic intelligence lag, or data blindness, caused by the shutdown.
This is the invisible cost of the shutdown. The Bureau of Economic Analysis, the BEA, issued notices on November 26th, rescheduling major releases,
including the crucial Q3 gross domestic product estimate and personal income data.
Yes, and the lack of timely data creates substantial risk.
Why does delaying GDP and personal income data specifically matter for decision making?
These reports are the lifeblood of economic policy. The Federal Reserve relies on timely GDP and income data to determine if the economy is overheating or contracting, which directly influences decisions on interest rates.
And private investors rely on this data to allocate capital and assess market risk.
Of course. So when policymakers and investors are operating in an informational vacuum, not knowing if Q3 GDP was strong or weak, they are much more prone to making errors.
Either over-tightening monetary policy during a slowdown or failing to address inflationary pressures effectively.
The shutdown has essentially impaired the economy's ability to self-correct by blinding its key stewards.
To wrap up our exhaustive review, let's analyze the state of government services. And there's a surprising success story in customer experience, but it's contrasted with some major oversight failures.
It is interesting. Despite the chaos of workforce cuts and the shutdown, customer satisfaction with federal benefits and services actually reached a two-decade high.
That's according to the fiscal year 2025 scorecard from the American Customer Satisfaction Index, the ACSI.
Right. And it suggests that core benefit agencies like Social Security or Basic Veterans Services are adapting well to process demands.
Are there any immediate caveats to that overall positive score?
Yes. While the average is up, the two agencies most directly involved in the crisis and the workforce reduction strategy, that's the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, and the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, both scored significantly lower on the Customer Experience Index.
Which indicates that agencies involved in critical internal administrative support or intense security functions are struggling more than the benefit delivery programs.
That's a fair takeaway.
Let's focus on the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA. They're a high-stakes customer service provider under immense pressure this week.
The TSA is navigating the high-stakes holiday travel period, and they're expecting to screen a massive 17.8 million passengers between November 25th and December 2nd.
And despite that volume, their customer satisfaction related to the screening experience is remarkably high.
It's hovering around 93 to 94%.
What's driving the success? Is it just the speed of getting people through security?
Surprisingly, the research indicates the progress isn't primarily driven by speed or efficiency. The highest correlation with satisfaction is the officers' perceived professionalism and respect during interactions.
Especially during secondary screenings or complex bag checks.
Exactly. And this is a direct result of mandatory training that was implemented back in 2019, specifically designed to address customer service and interpersonal communication.
So it shows that targeted administrative investments in human capital, even within a high-stress security environment, can yield measurable customer experience improvements.
An administrative fix that actually worked. But there's a massive accountability gap that undermines the government-wide effort to measure customer experience.
And what's that?
That is the structural problem. The government-wide customer experience dashboard, which is supposed to provide real-time public data on feedback from over 40 major federal services,
hasn't been updated.
It has not been updated since September of 2024. This lack of transparency means that while individual agencies like the TSA can track their progress, the overall accountability system, which is critical for identifying systemic service failures, is currently blind.
And that's especially concerning when the federal workforce is being drastically cut, because poor service is often an inevitable consequence of reduced capacity.
Without data, Congress and the public simply cannot hold agencies accountable for service degradation.
Finally, we saw a critical new Government Accountability Office GAO report finding major oversight issues within the Department of Veterans Affairs' massive contracted disability exam program.
This is a program of immense scale.
Yeah.
$5 billion dedicated to disability exams, with over 90% of those exams outsourced to private contractors.
And the GAO found multiple oversight flaws that directly link back to staff capacity and quality control within the Veterans Benefits Administration, the VBA.
Yes, multiple flaws.
What were the specific ones identified by the GAO?
First, the VBA was not properly reviewing contractor error reports, which allowed systemic issues to fester. Second, and this is most concerning, the staff dedicated to conducting special focus reviews for complex, high-stakes issues.
Things like traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma, Gulf War illness claims.
Yes. That staff had been cut by 50%. Half. And the severe staff reduction led to massive delays in reviewing these complex cases, which means veterans with the most serious injuries were facing prolonged waits for accurate determinations.
And beyond the human cost of delay, was there a specific financial error resulting from this lax oversight?
Yes, there was a measurable fiscal error. The GAO found that the VBA's reliance on manual data entry and calculation checks led to $2.3 million in overpayments to contractors.
Wow.
The report highlights that without sufficient quality control staff, the VBA cannot adequately manage its massive contracted workload,
resulting in both financial waste and critically slower, lower quality service for veterans relying on timely disability compensation.
The VBA has agreed to implement the GAO's recommendations to improve its quality review and data management, but the damage is done.
We've concluded our analysis of November 26, 2025. We've mapped a 24-hour period where an immediate dramatic act of violence in the Capitol served as a deliberate and powerful justification for expanding executive control.
From the streets of Washington, D.C., to the fundamental redefinition of refugee status years after the fact, and to military strikes far out in the Caribbean.
What we have tracked is a government that is consolidating its power across three dimensions, asserting military and security control domestically and abroad.
Using administrative review to retroactively enforce political change on immigration.
And aggressively shrinking the bureaucracy while facing judicial and legislative checks at every single turn.
The friction points. The FBI targeting Congress, the Supreme Court preparing to redefine the limits of presidential power over the entire federal apparatus. These are now constant features of governance, not anomalies.
Indeed, it raises a fundamental question about the current state of political and legal life in the United States.
It does.
So, we leave you with this provocative thought to consider. When the executive branch is willing to use the tools of law enforcement to pursue its political critics in the legislature, and when the Supreme Court is poised to eliminate the independence of every major regulatory agency, does the traditional system of checks and balances still rely on deeply held constitutional law and precedent?
Or does its effectiveness now depend solely on the relative political will of the players and the avoidance of the next major defining crisis?
Thank you for diving depth with us.
Thank you.